Good morning and welcome to This Green Earth here on KPCW. I'm Claire Wiley. Chris Cherniak is out today. However, you'll still be hearing his voice because in the first part of our show, we will be rebroadcasting one of our favorite interviews with Peter Alagona. Now, Peter is an environmental history professor at UC Santa Barbara, that is. In the interview, we discuss his book, The Accidental Ecosystem, which tells the story about U.S. cities that went from having little wildlife to filling dramatically and unexpectedly with wild creatures. And then in the second half of the show, I have a live interview with Daniel Lewis, who is the senior curator for the history of science and technology at the Huntington Library, Art Museum, and Botanical Gardens in Southern California. Now, Lewis has just penned a new book. It's called 12 Trees, The Deep Roots of Our Future. You're not going to want to miss our discussion about this fascinating book, which details a compelling global exploration of nature and survival as seen via a dozen species of trees that represent the challenges facing our planet and the ways that scientists are working urgently to save our forests and our very own future as humans. That's all today on This Green Earth. So stay with us.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the show is Dr. Peter Alagona. He is an environmental history professor at UC Santa Barbara, and he's the author of the new book, The Accidental Ecosystem, People and Wildlife in American Cities. Dr. Alagona, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Hi, Chris and Claire. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Hey, first, before we get in, you're in Santa Barbara. You guys just got walloped by some storms. Maybe we have a few minutes to talk about that because there's environmental impacts going on right now in Santa Barbara. And South. Is everything okay at UC Santa Barbara?
Well, I have to say I made the kind of foolish mistake of driving home from a trip in Death Valley on Sunday afternoon, and so I went right into the brunt of it. Fortunately, we're all okay here, but one interesting thing that happened is during storms like this, my street tends to turn into something like a creek. And the reason for that is that there used to be a creek here, and that history of transformation of urban environments like the one I live in and like the one many of your listeners live in is a big part of the story of this book.
That's a wonderful segue. Unfortunate, as it is in that sense, atmospheric rivers provide a segue to our interview with you about your new book, The Accidental Ecosystem. But before we get to that, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in the environmental field and how did you become an environmental history professor?
Oh boy, well, I've always had a real interest in nature. And although many folks who study wildlife begin from a biological background, it occurred to me sort of early on becoming a lover of reading and writing and studying history, that there was something really important to be understood about how contemporary ecosystems not just function, but also came to be the way they are. And so I joined this field of environmental history about 20 years ago. And since then, I've been incredibly fortunate to be able to study a huge range of species from a historical perspective, from desert tortoises and kit foxes and condors to a current obsession of mine, which is the California grizzly bear, which has been considered extinct in the state where I live here for about 100 years. But some folks are now looking at the possibility of bringing it back.
And so you have written two books previous to this. Maybe a little bit about how they fed into your latest read and what that speaks to about maybe predictability or patterns in wildlife that we are now seeing them, you know, once we envision wildlife, mostly we think of national parks and these wild areas, but now we're thinking more in terms of urban areas. So can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, Claire. I mean, in a way, you're sort of describing my own personal journey as well as the journey of a field and many other folks out there. You know, I spent the first decade or so of my career studying issues having to do with endangered species conservation. And in many cases, endangered species are almost by definition species that most people don't get to see because they're often very rare. There are some exceptions to that. You can go to the South Rim of the Grand Canyon, for example, and see California condors. But in many cases, we don't get to see them. And so after about a decade or so of studying these issues, I was finishing up a bunch of projects. I was finishing up a first book. I tell this story in the preface of the book that we're talking about today. And I kind of was at the end of a very long work week, and I hopped on my bike to go home. And I had a little wildlife encounter on the way home. I was riding on the bike path, and I saw a bobcat. And we had a moment where we both sort of stopped and stared at each other from about 10 feet away. And, you know, I knew bobcats were around, but this was one of those moments where it was just like a forehead slapping kind of dumb moment where I realized that I'd been studying creatures that almost nobody ever sees, but I was interested in the relationship between people and wildlife, and all around me, there were all these amazing wild creatures. And so that got me really into thinking more about the relations between people and wild animals in cities.
So let's now talk about cities in general and how wildlife kind of, I guess over time have adapted to city life, let's say, semi-urban life. You say initially cities were developed without necessarily wildlife in mind?
Well, you know, this book is called The Accidental Ecosystem, People and Wildlife in American Cities, for a reason. And a big part of the argument, the thesis here, is that wildlife has sort of returned to many cities in numbers that were kind of unexpected even a few decades ago in the U.S., but also in some other parts of the world, in Europe and parts of East Asia, Latin America, elsewhere, in part due to decisions that were made by people decades ago, often for other reasons, not having to do with wildlife at all. And so this was a very unexpected set of developments, and people are still kind of wrapping their mind around what it means that areas that were long presumed to be kind of sacrifice zones in a way for ecological health and for wildlife have now become these weird, enriched urban habitats. And so just, you know, for an example, you know, before the middle of the 19th century in the United States, most cities had very few trees. And as a matter of fact, there were actually laws in some municipalities prohibiting tree planting. Trees were considered fire hazards during a time in American history when most structures were built of wood and when fire codes were not nearly as effective as they are now. And in many cases, insurance companies wouldn't even insure structures that were next to trees. And so this was a major disincentive. This changed in the 19th century, largely because folks, including physicians and civic leaders and others, realized that planting trees in cities had a range of benefits for people. But over time, as trees became, or as cities became more treed, greener and leafier, they also started to provide new kinds of habitat for creatures that couldn't survive there even just a few decades earlier. So this is an example of this kind of accidental ecosystem idea.
So now when I imagine this, it seems, you know, when we talk about the predictability of wildlife, we first went in there and pushed them all out. And now it seems like they're finding their way back because, like you said, people are putting in parks and trees, and this
backyards,
more resembles
yeah,
their natural habitat. So now they're filling in these spaces that, you know, I guess if you're talking about how they work and their patterns, that would make sense, right?
Well, you know, there's a term in the scientific literature, novel ecosystem. And a novel ecosystem really refers to a kind of ecological arrangement, an assemblage of species and habitat attributes that's really new in evolutionary and ecological history. And so, you know, areas of intensive agriculture, I think, are like that. Certainly cities are like that. There are very few, if any, species that have adapted in an evolutionary sense quickly enough that we can call them native, truly native to urban areas. And so these are kind of weird new ecosystems. On the other hand, there are aspects of cities that in some ways mimic, you know, often by accident, features of natural environments. And in North America in particular, this is kind of a fascinating thing. It was one of the first big aha moments that I had while working on this book, in part because of political and economic history of the United States. We tended to build our cities that became our biggest, most prosperous cities in places that were unusually biologically diverse and productive prior to the city forming. In some cases, this was because this was where some of the most prosperous and wealthy indigenous communities were located, in areas with a lot of natural resources year round. But they also became places of trade and commerce. And so it turns out that many of our cities are actually located in areas that have been biologically rich for a very long time.
And when we're speaking ecosystem species, we're not just talking about animals, you know, four-legged animals per se, but all species, whether it's animal or plant or insect. I mean, it covers quite an array of environmental systems that can adapt and evolve to adapt to urban or semi-urban settings, right?
Well, you know, Chris, when people think about wildlife in cities, and when we see, you know, if you see like a coyote, for example, right, you think, oh, that's kind of out of place, you know, that animal really belongs, you know, quote unquote, belongs in a natural area. But, you know, what these animals are responding to, and I think you're kind of pointing to this, is not some, you know, aesthetic sense of what many of us would define as natural or wild or even wilderness, you know, or even the lines we draw on a map around national parks. What they're responding to is habitat. Mm-hmm. If you see an animal in an urban area, it is there because it is somehow either just trying to pass through, perhaps, or because it's able in some way to take advantage of the features that we have in part created in those areas that add up to habitat. And so thinking about cities as habitats, multi-species habitats, is really different for a lot of folks who are not used to thinking about them that way. But that is the way that all of these other creatures, plants, animals of all kinds, are seeing the landscape and responding to it.
When you identify these wildlife that are finding habitats in urban areas, do you see common traits among them?
Oh, that's a great question. I love it. So going back about maybe 20 years to really the origins in the United States of urban ecology as a field that's really grown a lot over the last generation, there were a couple landmark papers that looked at this. And one, this is a little bit oversimplified, so keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. But one of those landmark papers defined three kinds of animals relative to urban environments: urban exploiters, urban adapters, and urban avoiders. The exploiters are animals that tend to do well in urban environments around the world. You see them wherever you go, you know, the crows and pigeons and certain kinds of rodents that are really able to take advantage of urban environments. We can talk about why that is in a second. I think we should come back to that.
Right.
The urban adapters, creatures that can do well around urban environments, but often require some refuge. And so these might be like the coyotes or the deer, or the raccoons that kind of forage in cities by night and then retreat into green spaces during the day. Oftentimes they commute like many of us. And then the urban avoiders, these are animals that don't do well in urban environments, that tend to avoid them. And when you see them there, it's often because they're just trying to pass through and get from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And so in Southern California, where I live, one of the best examples of this is mountain lions, right? Why are some species able to be urban exploiters? Well, there's a cluster of traits that many of them have in common, as different as they may seem. So what are these traits? Well, they tend to be relatively intelligent, at least as we would define it, compared to other animals in their kind of taxonomic group. They tend to be omnivorous. They tend to be cultural in the sense that they learn lessons and pass them on to their young. And they tend to be habitat generalists, meaning that they can live in a wide variety of areas. Now, Chris and Claire, what does that remind you of?
Give me a hint.
It could remind you of people.
Yeah.
Humans have all of those qualities.
How we don't so fall far
I'm
from
not on your
the
program
ecosystem.
to tell your listeners that, you know, they have something in common with rats and pigeons, but
right.
Biologically, ecologically, we're doing some of the same things that allow us to exploit these kinds of spaces.
Like people that identify with pizza rat.
That's right.
What? Okay.
That's exactly right. You nailed it.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Peter Alagona. He is an environmental historian, conservation scientist, and nature culture geographer. He's also the professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the author of the new book, The Accidental Ecosystem, People and Wildlife in American Cities. So, Peter, we talked about exploiters of urban settings. How about some examples of adapters?
Yeah, adapters. So these are the creatures that can benefit from exploiting the resources in urban environments, but they're not totally comfortable there. They often live along the edges, along the urban wildland interface, or sometimes, like I said a minute ago, they commute, right? So they may forage, for example, by night when the dangers, the hazards that urban environments present may be a little bit less acute, but they can still access the resources that these enriched habitats provide. And so I think among the most famous of these are what are called the meso predators or meso carnivores, medium-sized animals that are either carnivorous or omnivorous. And so we can all name those, right? So coyotes, mm-hmm. skunks, foxes, possums, you know, that group of animals have traits that enable them to do this kind of urban adapting in a way to take advantage while also avoiding some of those hazards. And there are others too, but these are some of the strategies that they use.
Might that also include bobcats, or do bobcats fall under kind of the rubric
they,
of
they
avoiders?
Do. You know, an interesting thing about bobcats, I love bobcats.
Yeah.
Amazing, beautiful species. You know, they are, so they're not omnivorous. They're really obligate carnivores. They're hunters. They tend to eat rodents and rabbits, which we have a lot of around where I live, a lot of western cottontails. They tend to really try to avoid people, mm-hmm. As many wild feline species do. But the thing about bobcats is their prey doesn't, right? So those western cottontails don't really avoid people. And so the fact that they are so reliant on these prey species really often draws them into suburban environments where they can hopefully, like I said, take advantage of those resources while avoiding some of those hazards. You know, some of the biggest hazards that are presented, I think, in urban environments are very obvious. For birds, they're often collisions with buildings. Mm-hmm. For terrestrial animals that are locked to the ground, that don't have wings, they're often automobiles.
I mentioned bobcats because here in Park City, whether it's because of social media or, you know, ring cameras or door cameras or so, there's more sightings of bobcats as they become comfortable. As you say, they're becoming more comfortable with the human nature interface, but also sources of food, including, unfortunately, pets. And so so there's more opportunities for them, and they seem to be getting not bolder, but they don't have any problem coming up to patio doors and hanging out on back decks on a sunny afternoon and such. So they're getting, again, their numbers seem to be increasing here.
Can avoiders turn into adapters, I guess?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, that's a really great question. You know, I was in Death Valley, I mentioned this weekend, and I was in the parking lot at the old refurbished beautiful inn there. At the park, and there was a coyote standing right in the parking lot staring at us, you know, and it was clear that he had plenty of natural habitat around there. This wasn't an incursion into his habitat. It was clear that he was coming there for a reason and had probably been doing it. And so something very similar can happen with bobcats. These are intelligent animals that learn lessons. That's one of the reasons that they can survive in these environments. I think that there's just a couple things to note about what you said. One is that the advent of technologies like, you know, remote cameras, camera traps, this has made people aware of trends that were actually have been going on for many decades, right? And so we're now more aware of it than we used to, but the processes that led to these animals being more around us have been going on in many cases since the 1970s or 1980s, or in some cases even longer. Another thing that's really important to recognize is that although some of these meso-level, medium-sized carnivores and omnivores have very bad reputations for hunting pets, and in some cases they do, this is often overblown, and we know this from studies of their gut contents. And so bobcats, you know, most bobcats are under 20 pounds. They're unlikely to take larger animals. It does happen occasionally, but it's quite rare. And so isolated incidents on social media become conventional wisdom, even though oftentimes scientific studies, systematic studies, provide a much different kind of picture. And let's also just remember that with animals like bobcats, you know, they're actually out there hunting a lot of animals that we would rather have few of around, fewer of around. And so bobcats are taking rats and other rodents that are often garden pests, for example, pests around our homes. And so they're providing a really important ecological service, and we should, I think we should really value that and actually try to figure out ways to coexist with and even accentuate those things.
Yeah, but as you alluded to too, they can have a bad public image sometimes, because when people post photos of bobcats and coyotes in particular, sometimes the captions will include like, bring your pets and your small children inside, you know, because not only will they take your children, but they will do a better job at raising them. And I think that's one of the greatest fears. But
you know, with coyotes and bobcats, I think part of the psychology here, in addition to the things we've talked about, is that one is very, very close to a dog and one is very close to a cat.
Right.
And so we're kind of like, on the one hand, seeing them through the lens of the animals with which many of us are most familiar, which is pets. On the other hand, I think a lot of people view a coyote as kind of like a bad dog, you know, bad dog. And so I think that, you know, thinking about how they use habitat, about what they're actually doing, about what they're actually out there eating, and how they're living, I think for me has generated a tremendous amount of respect and value for these creatures. And I would encourage others to kind of look further into that and to really try to better understand the ecologies of the creatures that we live with.
I do wish they'd work on their cries at night. That could help their public image a lot if it wasn't so hair-raising. But let's turn to avoiders now. Which ones are that fall into that classification of avoiders? I'll take a wild guess, grizzly bears?
Now you're talking about one of my favorite species.
Okay.
So avoiders, I think you can think of as falling into a couple main categories. One kind of avoider is an animal that requires a lot of space, that travels over large distances, and that when it comes into contact with people, sometimes there can be issues, right? Mm. And so, you know, grizzly bears certainly are in that category. Mountain lions are in that category. Wolves are in that category. They'd rather have nothing to do with us at all. They really try to avoid us. And when we come together, it's, you know, it can occasionally cause problems, although oftentimes it's just an amazing wildlife sighting. So those are avoiders. But then there's another group of avoiders too. And these are the animals that are unlike the generalists we've been talking about, that can live in a wide variety of different kinds of habitats. These are specialists. And what they really require, based on their evolutionary histories and their ecologies, are natural habitats, the habitats within which they and their ancestors have evolved. And so when urban areas sprawl out into the countryside and gobble up natural habitats, these are often the animals that are the losers in that equation when some others become the winners. And so it's both animals that range over large areas and require lots of resources on the one hand, And then on the other hand, those ones that really are restricted to very specific kinds of habitats.
So here, again, in Park City, I'm thinking possibly moose, but more notably elk as examples of avoiders, generally.
I think that that's probably right. And I think that in cases where, for example, moose or elk become something less like avoiders, that's a potential issue, you know. And I think that the biggest issue here often is associated with automobile accidents, right? Yeah. And, you know, this is, if I could just kind of connect two dots here, because we're having such a fun conversation. There have been some studies that have come out recently that have shown, one in particular that looked at New England, that showed that based on almost any kind of mathematical set of assumptions that you could come up with, having pumas, mountain lions, return to New England would make people safer. Why is that?
Right.
Well, the reason is because in most parts of North America, pumas, most pumas, not all, are specialists on hunting deer. And in many parts of New England, there are very large populations of white-tailed deer that have rebounded from something close to zero over 100 years ago and are extremely abundant now. And the main source of wildlife conflicts, property damage, and injuries as well in those areas has to do with car collisions. And so if you think about the relationship between mountain lions and deer, not just preying on them, but also changing the way they move through the landscape, then returning mountain lions to New England, even if you assume that occasionally there's going to be a mountain lion that takes somebody's pet, that sort of thing, or even that gets hit by a car too, having those animals back on the landscape actually makes people much safer over time. And so that's a counterintuitive thing for a lot of people to wrap their mind around,
right.
But the math is pretty compelling.
Yeah, we're building these pathways. We have a corridor for wildlife on one of our highways.
Yeah, overpasses, underpasses.
It's been a problem here, and the elk do move, and I think a lot of people that do live in this area have adapted. Like you said, humans aren't far off from
right.
these exploiters. we've adapted to them coming through the neighborhoods because they will come through our golf course. And I think that people are aware of that. So there's this adaptation of when we kind of know their patterns of moving through.
And recognizing the value and the benefits of animals like that in our backyard, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Well, they're certainly being drawn in some cases, to resources
right.
like lush grasses, you know, during the summertime, or, you know, available water at certain times, that kind of thing. But I think that the best thing that we can do for some of those large, wide-ranging animals is to provide them opportunities just to pass through and do what they do. And that is why, as you say, there's so much effort right now where you live and where I live. To create more pathways that increase connectivity among natural habitats so that these animals can really move through without having to stop, to linger, to get too accustomed to living in urban areas, and then to create problems for people and also for themselves.
We only have a minute or so left, and so this is the part where I ask you a question that will take 5 minutes to answer, but too bad. You mentioned, you know, the possibility of reintroducing puma back east, or otherwise, you know, cougar, mountain lion, that type of cat, and the environmental and benefits that it could provide as part of a natural ecosystem. I'll ask the big one here out west: wolves. You know, they're definitely probably fall under the avoider category, but you know, the introduction of wolves, even into rural settings, is fraught with, controversy. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh my gosh, Chris, that is a big question.
I know, sorry.
Let me offer this. Wolves can potentially cause property damage to livestock. They also provide a huge range of ecological services. They're amazing animals, and they're also very important for many indigenous groups throughout the West, as are many other species. And so we need to think about this in a holistic way. We have, over the last 20 years, we've developed a tremendous amount of tools that we know can work to reduce risk to people while increasing benefits and providing opportunities for coexistence. Now what we need to do is we need to reform our institutions, we need to update our laws, and we need to put our money where our mouth is a little bit and invest in these things so that people who live in rural communities, who work the land, who produce off of it, can continue to live those lifestyles and be engaged in that kind of really important activity, while at the same time providing space for the kind of ecological recovery that will really benefit society as a whole, and wolves are a poster child for that.
All right. Dr. Peter Alagona, environmental history professor at UC Santa Barbara and the author of the new book, The Accidental Ecosystem, People and Wildlife in American Cities. Real quick, website that people can go to learn more, say, about the book or, more importantly, about your work.
Yeah, you can check out some of my work at peteralagona.com. You can go to the Environmental Studies website at UC Santa Barbara. And if you're interested in grizzly bears in California, calgrizzly.com, and there's going to be a lot more going on about that over this year with the 100th anniversary of the last credible sighting of a grizzly bear in California and a new conversation about what it might take to bring them back here.
And we'll have you back on the show for that.
Yes, we will. Definitely. Thank you very much, Peter.
And you are listening to KPCW Park City. This is This Green Earth. And my next guest is Daniel Lewis, who is the senior curator for the history of science and technology at the Huntington Library, Art Museum, and Botanical Gardens in Southern California. Also a writer, college professor, and environmental historian. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about this. You have just penned a new book. It is called 12 Trees, The Deep Roots of Our Future. And in it, you describe 12 different species. And we're going to get to that and dive into this book in just a little bit. But first, I'd like for you to share a little bit about yourself and your background and what led you into this field.
So I'm a rare book and manuscript curator in the history of science and technology here at the Huntington Library, which is really one of the world's most renowned research libraries. And I'm surrounded by botanic gardens, 200 acres of spectacular gardens. We get about 1 million visitors a year through here. And I'm really responsible for a very broad landscape of natural history and the natural sciences and the physical sciences. And being a historian really is a bully pulpit because everything has a history, and I can write about things I'm interested in, and I'm very interested in the natural world. And so I've written a couple of books about birds, and I wrote a book about trees. I'm surrounded by trees here at the Huntington, and some of them are astonishing. And so it was a chance to talk about trees, and also a chance to talk about them in a way that was both science forward and was both very approachable by a lay audience, by the culturally curious, I suppose, would be one way to think about it. So I wanted to talk about trees, having been sort of nestled here in this spectacular botanical setting, because it gave me a chance to talk about the natural world and its science, but to do it in a way that really didn't either confuse people or talk down to them. And I've tried to sort of blend science and sensibility in the course of thinking about trees. And that's really how I think about the natural world. It's something we all have a way to understand through our senses. You know, at the most basic level, we can walk among plants and animals, and we can come to understand them, you know, through sensory data, but there's a lot of science behind all that. So I wanted to explicate the science and really clarify to a wide audience just why that science was important. So 12 Trees is a chance to talk about these 12 particular trees scattered around the world.
Yeah, and so there are calculations out there that say that we have about 73,000 species of trees on Earth, which is kind of hard to wrap the head around. But then you distill it down into these 12 trees that you highlight in the book. How and why did you choose the trees in which you did?
That's a super fair question. Like, why these 12 trees? Let me first say before I answer that I could have picked almost any 12 trees. But I picked these 12 trees because there's a climate change story struck through this book. And climate change's effects are very heterogeneous. They're not the same from place to place. They work in different ways. And they don't have any, they have very little geographic overlap. So I wanted trees that didn't really share space so much with other trees, but that it were affected by climate in different ways around the planet. But I've come to think about these 70, you know, you mentioned those 73,000 trees. Imagine yourself at, say, a cocktail party or just a party. And you've got maybe 200 people at this big party, and you're walking around and you're looking at people, and some of them are stately and elegant, you know, some of them are messy, some of them are quiet and sort of crouched in the corner almost, some of them are extroverted and chatty, some of them are spilling their drink and knocking crumbs on the floor. And it was like that. It was like I surrounded myself with a number of possibilities, and then I got to work getting to know them. And they all have very different characteristics. And in the course of really getting to know them, they really became comrades. And as I say in the book, in some meaningful ways, they actually found me. They're hard to miss. I have a couple of coast redwood trees right outside my window, for instance, which is one of my 12 trees. It's not the monster that it grows to further up north here in Southern California. Up in Northern California and Oregon and the Pacific Northwest, they grow to be, you know, they're crowding 400 feet in height. But they're hard to miss even at, say, 100 feet. That's a pretty tall tree. And so I was able to really have my own relationship, I suppose, with these 12 trees. And I've really gotten to know them all very well and in very different ways.
Yeah, and we're going to cover some of these trees in particular, but I did notice in the book that you very much find the resemblance trees have to humans and how you describe that cocktail party. I've heard you also describe it as a family, how we always have those aunts or those uncles or those direct relatives that we can describe so greatly. And you give these trees that interconnectivity to humans and the good influences maybe that they can have on us, on how we navigate and treat our environment. Can you maybe draw some lines there of how these trees can tell us how we can exist among our natural world?
I think there are a number of lessons along those lines to learn. So if you look at the bristlecone pine, which is, you know, prominent in the Four Corners region, you know, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah, one of the things about the bristlecone pine is that there's not much that we can do to monetize it or capitalize upon it. And, you know, that's been an American, not an American, that's been a human reflex for centuries and centuries. How do we make money off of this? And so to be confronted with a tree in which there really is no way to make money, you can't use its lumber. It's too cracked and doesn't work for lumber. It doesn't produce any usable fruits or oils like some of the other trees in the book, like the olive tree do. And so then you're confronted in a way with the fact that it can do nothing for us, but it sort of highlights its right to life in a way. And so this sort of right to life for trees is scattered throughout the book as well and other trees. Without beating people over the head about it, I think you can have a tincture of that idea and people will get it. You know, trees have a right to live. Trees are important for their own purposes. They serve us many purposes. They sequester carbon. They produce oxygen. They provide shelter. They provide shade. They smell beautiful in some circumstances. But the fact that they have a right to live, I think, is something that we're confronted with when you have a tree that doesn't give us something that we can immediately grab at and take hold of, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I think in that relationship of humans to trees, we also see that resilience. And you share with us really ways in which trees have shown their resilience and how they adapt and change. And, you know, one of the things that you also said in the book is really a single factor that takes a species out of existence isn't there. It's a succession of slower and more diffused pressures. So when they're facing these pressures and these things are happening, how are you seeing them adapt, or how are you seeing that resilience in trees and in your explanations in this book?
Well, you know, one of the things that is certainly true about the natural world is that everything is in the process of changing into something else, turning into something else through evolution. And we can't see some of those wheels turning. They're too fine. And that's why we have species and why we have subspecies is, you know, we've taken a snapshot out of time to understand where something is at a particular moment. It might be a long moment. It might be 100 years. It might be 1,000 years. But it might be a year, because evolution can be, as we now understand about it, can be fast as well as slow. And so the fact that things can evolve rapidly in response to difficult circumstances, in some ways is a lifeline for these trees. You know, they can adapt to warmer climates. And I think that's one of the most exciting things about some of these trees, like the coast redwood, for instance. We've got good evidence now that it and all of its ecosystem critters, you know, the things that are in above, below, and above it, are able to evolve quickly to a warming climate. And so I find that to be a hopeful note in this whole endeavor of, you know, life surviving on the planet in the middle of a changing climate, is that, you know, there are tools built in that turn things into something else. And so, you know, there's natural selection, there's mutation, there's genetic drift. There are all these things that cause things to take advantage of circumstances and survive. You know, the natural world is born to survive in some ways.
Mm-hmm. And I like how you refer to the tree survival tactics as its gifts. And in your studies with the species of tree at Easter Island, the Toromiro tree, we saw its existence, it was squelched, right? And now it's being reintroduced. How is that going? And what are some of the gifts, I guess, of that tree that you can see that it might come back to existence?
So the Toromiro, Sulphura Toromiro, is a tree that went, it was extirpated. In other words, it went locally extinct. It doesn't, it spent hundreds of thousands of years evolving on Easter Island. And then it died off. It was used for wood. And finally, the last one was dug up sometime in the early 1960s by Thor Heyerdahl, the guy who wrote the book Kon-Tiki. He carted these seeds back to Sweden and other parts of Europe. And so now the Toromiro grows in a dozen different botanic collections around the world, mostly in institutional hands. But there, that's an example of a tree that has somehow managed to survive very far from home. You know, trees need local environments. They need the things they're adapted to. And now the great twist with the Toromiro is trying to reintroduce it back to Easter Island or Rapa Nui. The roots and the mycorrhizae and the roots can't shake hands with the soil, as it were, on Rapa Nui. So they've spent several decades trying to reintroduce the tree. It's a complicated endeavor, and they've made multiple expeditions to try to introduce it back into the island. I think they're closing in on a solution that works. It's a question of getting the soil amended properly so that it has the right biochemistry necessary for this tree to grow. And so they're getting there. But the Toromiro has managed to survive. You know, it's an expat. It's an expatriate that's existed around the world for a half a century or more now, because of the fact that it was removed essentially from Easter Island, from Rapa Nui.
And what kind of human interactions, or how do we play a role in species of trees either leaving an area or being reintroduced into an area? How is that human factor taking hold in this world?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think one of the things that's true is we have to recognize that we have caused difficulties for the planet. And I think at the same time, because of that, we have an obligation to help the planet. And so there is a way for us to press our hand on the scale of survival for these trees in a way that is benevolent. So we can do things like test plant these trees in drier climates very carefully, slightly dry climates, and see how they do. We can do certain kinds of botanical modifications to plants. We can do bioengineering to get things to grow. There's a tree called the bald cypress that it's a coastal tree that lives in swamps. It's being inundated by ocean waters as tides come in and storm surges become more common. The bald cypress is becoming more susceptible to salt water. Well, they found trees, individuals, because there's a lot of individual variation from tree to tree. They found trees that tend to be more resistant to salt, to saline, than others. And so they've tried to increase the number of trees that are saline resistant to be able to fight that particular battle. So there are ways that there are gentle forms of engineering. It's not like we're creating a Franken tree. It's that we're trying to, you know, take advantage of trees' own natural gifts and modify them in a way that gives them a leg up or a root up or a trunk up or something.
Yeah. And in your research in writing this book, when you're studying these trees, what stood out to you, because this is your background, was there anything, though, that took you aback a little bit or surprised you that you can share?
Oh, gosh, so many things. I mean, I suppose across all these trees, the thing that is most surprising to me is how many different interactions they have. You know, these are not sterile, you know, poles in the ground of wood. They are, they have what are called commensurates. They have things that rely on them. They have things that live in and among them. They have gigantic, you know, the California condor can find a nest in the coast redwood because it's a huge tree. And for a huge bird, you need a huge tree for it to nest in. But there are also many tiny interactions. You know, there are microbes and there are little insects and there are things that burrow under the trees that need that particular environment to survive and to thrive. So I think it's the fact that these trees are not just trees, they're ecosystems each unto themselves. And it's just, and it's really, it's an almost endless parade of interactions. And I think that was really startling to me.
Yeah, this book is most definitely based or grounded in science and the biology of these trees, but you also very gracefully weave in that cultural aspect of these trees. Can you provide us some examples of that?
Yeah, I've tried to combine sensibility and science in a way that shows, you know, that these trees, because many of them are things that we interact with. And so you think about the olive tree, Olea europaea, you know, it's a tree that we've coveted for its oil and for its fruit. And at the same time, you know, we can't covet it so much that the tree, you know, disappears, is endangered or goes extinct. We need those things as they're cultural things. I think it's okay to say that humans need things culturally. We need those things. And so so that's probably the tree with the most sort of cultural interaction, because, you know, I draw a long comparison in the book between wine and olive oil and how they're similar, but at the same time, they're not similar in different particular ways. But, you know, there are many ways we think about taste and beauty and flavor and aesthetic. That's the word I'm looking for. There's an aesthetic to all these things that we appreciate. And you know, it seems like this idea of aesthetics and food might be fairly far removed from trees, but of course it's not. And there are many reasons we get food stuff from trees, but that's one of the key cultural touchstones, I think, for this is, you know, we've all shared talk and tapenade, you know, sitting around a table. Yeah. And so I think there's a cultural imperative to protect these trees for our own sensibilities in some ways.
Yeah, wine and olive oil are two of my very favorite things. So I thank you for diving into that more deeply. And you're right, culturally, it does also lend itself to talking about, again, that relationship that we have with the natural world and how similarly we can see ourselves in these trees and see what they're offering the world. And maybe we as humans of what we can bring to our natural world as we go through these changes in climate. And obviously that is a through line throughout the book, is climate change. And a lot of the times on this show, you know, we discuss climate change and it can be very heavy. What can you provide in hope that you found in your writings around this and around climate change that we can maybe look to?
You know, I've tried to not be a scold about climate change because plenty of people have things to say about how dire it is. I want people to understand that there are a million small to middling to big ways to fight something like climate change, or at least to regulate climate change. And I think trees provide that because I'm not sure I want to put in a military way, but I will for now. They fight many battles on our behalf. You know, they do things like, they do all sorts of indirect and direct ways to improve, I guess, our climate broadly. You know, they prevent erosion because of their roots. They provide shade that cools the planet down. They sequester carbon, getting it out of the atmosphere. They have a bunch of strategies, essentially, that are, in some ways, just the way they live. And you know, carbon is good for trees. They need carbon. And so it helps them grow. So it's not that it's an evil that they're sequestering. It's just something that's hard for us. So their job really has been, and the things they've done, have been, you know, there've been multiple ways that they have aimed to help us, and that they help us in ways that range from the tiny to the big. And so one of them is the aesthetics of trees, the beauty, the smell, just the fact that you can be among them and find a moment of peace in a crowded, busy, gritty world really is a win, I think, for humans and for trees too.
Absolutely. And I think we are very lucky here in the area that we are surrounded by when we go for hikes, and we can take that all in, and we can take that deep breath and live amongst them and breathe amongst them. And I think this book is not only educational, it's poetic. And it does provide just a wonderful new way for us to gaze up at these glorious trees that are around us and to learn more about the ones around the world that perhaps we can go visit someday. So I appreciate you being on the show, Daniel. Is there a website or a place that people can go to so they can find out more information, not only about you, but to also get this book?
You know, I'd go to the Simon & Schuster page for the book. If you just Google Simon & Schuster and 12 Trees and Daniel Lewis, it'll come right up. And you can get it on Amazon as well. It's also out as an audio book. I picked an audio reader, a guy named Kaleo Griffith, because he's from Hawaii. And he's got the right pronunciation of all the, there's a Hawaii story among the Toromiro, the Easter Island tree. Mm. And so there's an audio book available on audible.com. which is a good, really lovely rendering of it in audio form. So
fantastic. I mean, well, Daniel Lewis, thank you so much for joining us. Daniel Lewis is a senior curator for the History of Science and Technology at the Huntington Library, Art Museum, and Botanical Gardens in Southern California. And he has just written the book, 12 Trees, The Deep Roots of Our Future. We appreciate you being on the show, and we look forward to what you do next.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this. It's been fun.